Welcome to the hashtag STRS podcast. I'm Amy Hall, and hello, Greg.
Having a Greg, little hard you're also time here. Getting going there, Amos.
You know, I almost said the Stand to Reason podcast. We're actually recording this much closer to when we usually record the regular podcast,
right,
and I got confused for a second there. Yeah. the next one on my mind already.
Yeah. Well, here we are.
Here we are.
What do you got for me?
Here's a question from Hannah Elizabeth. How should we treat remarriages following non-biblical divorce? How does this compare to other non-biblical marriage, such as LGBTQ? Affirm? Celebrate? Something else? What if it's a parent's remarriage?
Well, I think this is a little bit tricky, but there's some distinction I can make right away that actually we talked about and you suggested to me. So I'm bib sourcing you here, Amos, because this is a good observation. A same-sex marriage is not a marriage. All right. Frank Beckwith had a clever little saying, and it may take a moment for it to sink in. Frank is a philosopher over at Baylor, and we co-authored a book, Relativism, together many years ago. And he can always turn a phrase. But what he said was regarding he was speaking of same-sex marriage, and he said, just because you can eat an ashtray doesn't make it food. Okay? The point is, because you can go through certain motions does not establish a thing as a particular thing. So just because you can eat an ashtray doesn't mean that the thing that you're eating is food. Okay? Just because you walk down the aisle with another person of the same sex and make a pledge doesn't mean that what you've just done is a marriage, even though this is the common way to refer to it. And I wouldn't make a big fuss with people on the language at this point, because it's causing trouble with no good purpose in mind. But insofar as I'm answering this question, it is important to make this distinction. It's not a marriage. A marriage is when a man and a woman join themselves together for the purpose of creating a family, and a family is a natural thing. What I mean is it's determined by the way reality is structured. It's not merely a convention. Marriage is not a convention. It isn't any old thing, whatever we want to call it. Because why don't we just say, if you have members of a bridge club, why can't you say you're all married? Well, because that's not what marriage is. Well, marriage is something in particular. And it's tied to the nature of reality. And so when same-sex marriage, so-called, is advanced, then people are advancing something that is different than what a marriage actually is. And so when we are asked to celebrate the distortion or perversion of an institution like marriage, and I'm making those adjectives, I'm using them in light of God's purposes for it, okay? God has certain intention, and a violation of that intention is a distortion of the intention, okay? So I'm looking at it from a Godward perspective and a biblical perspective. When that is done, then we are not to participate in celebrating it, okay? So then the question – and so therefore, a remarriage that is not a legitimate remarriage is no less a marriage. When I say legitimate, maybe that's not the right word, is not a proper remarriage given God's point of view here in this. That doesn't mean it's not a marriage. In the first case, same-sex marriage isn't a marriage. A remarriage of two people that were divorced for the wrong reasons and maybe ought not to have gotten remarried, though they did, well, that may be a wrong action to get remarried, but what they do is still a real marriage. And once they're remarried, even though they ought not have gotten married, I don't think it's appropriate to dissolve the marriage, all right? In the same way, if a Christian marries a non-Christian, this is wrong. God's clear on this, 2 Corinthians 5. However, that doesn't mean that the relationship should be annulled or something like that. No, my posture is going to be, okay, this is a rough start, but I want to do what I could as a friend, family member, whatever, to encourage that it survives. I do not have the same attitude about a so-called same-sex marriage, okay? But I do about a real marriage in a covenant of some sort before God. And so that's why I think that you're talking about two entirely different kinds of things. Now, it may be that a person is aware that this new marriage is not a morally healthy one. And so you may choose not to celebrate this by going to the service, right? However, once that's done, and this is something that that applies in a certain way, different rationale, certain way, even to same-sex marriage, that we suggest it stand to reason that you not attend the ceremony, but you still maintain relationship with the people that you're close with. So after the ceremony, which you didn't attend, you can still invite that couple over to be visitors in your home and have a meal or go out to dinner to try to maintain the positive relationship so there's an opportunity for the gospel. So what you don't do is to just disregard the relationship because of the nature of the relationship. They're not Christians. They're we don't expect them to live like Christians do. And so we're not going out of the world, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5. We're staying in touch with the world, even though we are careful at certain points of contact not to celebrate the thing that God says is wrong. All right. Mm-hmm. So that's the distinction, I think, that is a fair one to make.
I thank you
for that hat tip here to Amy Paul.
Thanks, Greg. Yeah, there is a qualitative difference between someone redefining the definition of a marriage versus marrying somebody they shouldn't marry. And one problem is, Greg, I thought you explained that really well, especially by starting with the point that marriage is a real thing. It's not just a convention. It's right. Tied to the reality that one man and one woman creates new life. Mm-hmm. And so that's why that union was protected. And one thing, I think people are confused about why Christians were against same-sex marriage, and it's because they never heard the actual arguments that Christians were making. They were always talking about how this was just an expansion of marriage because we weren't allowing some people to get married. Well, the truth is, nobody was denied the right to get married. Right. Any person was allowed to get married as long as it was under the definition of marriage. So it's not that someone, an individual, is being denied the right to enter into marriage. Everyone had that right. But you don't have a right to redefine what marriage is. And that's what was really at play here. Right. They wanted to redefine marriage as a covenant, or not a covenant, but a contract between two individuals.
Right. Regardless of their gender or sex. Right.
Yeah, and that's a radical change.
Yes, it's actually worse than that, though, Amy, because the fact of the matter, and this, we argued this at Stand to Reason long before Obergefell in what, now 2015, I guess it was. It's amazing to think that's now 6 years old. The Supreme Court decision that by fiat declared that same-sex marriage was constitutional right. That what they're doing is, it's not only they could get married in a certain sense, with the blessing of the community, the official community, the government, as long as they stayed within the definition. Even if they didn't stay within the definition, they could still form those unions and were not hindered. No one was keeping anybody from walking down the aisle and pledging their lives until death do them part and setting up housekeeping and going on a honeymoon. Their whole cottage industry is devoted to that kind of thing. No one was stopping any liberty of any kind. What was being withheld was public approval in the form of a marriage license. But in order to do that, what the public would have to say is that there is no difference between a heterosexual union and a same-sex union. But of course, that's obviously false. There is a difference. There's a huge difference, but that's the difference that was contested. You can't say there's a difference because on one way of thinking, there is no difference. And therefore, if there is no difference, you treat equals equally, and you ought to give us the same social status, us, that is, same-sex couples, the same social status as heterosexual couples. And this was being demanded of the people. Notice that this is what happens when the government steps in. This is the people saying, declaring there is no difference. Now, I made this point very clearly in the midst of this debate in the early 2000s and even before that when it was coming up. This is an attempt to eradicate the distinction between the sexes. All right. Now, for me to say that now, it is completely uncontroversial because you sow to the wind, you reap the whirlwind, and the whirlwind of the eradication of the distinction between the sexes is all around us. Not only can you not make distinctions in the sense that you can't say this is appropriate for men but not for women or for women and not for men, you can't even make the distinction that there is such a thing as a man or a woman in the objective sense of the word. Because what is male and what is female is now not the eye of the beholder. I go for that because the eye does not betray what is, you know, in this particular case, what is real in front of a person. It is in the mind of the holder, not the beholder. That's what gender is. Sex is gone. It's all gender. That is what's in my mind. And what's in my mind is reality. That's a radical relativism. And notice then, if what's in my mind is not the same as what my body says, it's irrelevant. I am what I believe I am. And so what that has done is erased the distinction between male and female in any objective sense. You could be a male one day, as far as this goes, and a female the next day. And some people do that. They go from satisfied with their gender to getting dysphoric and adopting the other gender, okay, and so what we see being played out now is that very thing, the obliteration of the sexes, and that became legally legitimate course of action with the Obergefell.
And just as an aside here. Carl Truman's book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, I recommend that everyone read that book. I think it's the most important book of the last 10 years that I've read. And it's not an easy book to read. It might take you a while. You might have to think about it carefully as you're going. But if you want to understand how we got to this point philosophically, starting a couple hundred years ago, then that book is so helpful in understanding. So in terms of the redefinition of marriage, when they disconnected marriage from the reality that the reproductive system only works when you have a man and a woman, only then does it function the way it functions. That's the only type of union that creates life, and therefore marriage is the way that that is managed. When they removed that, there is actually no limiting principle now.
That's right.
There's no reason. The reason why marriage is two people is because there are two sexes. There's the man and a woman. Now you've got the complete thing. That's all that you should have in that. But there's no limiting principle if it's just two people who care about each other.
As well, it doesn't even have to be that. Caring about each other is not a requirement. It is practically, in practical terms, how it works out. But it's not a requirement. I mean, the fact is, after Obergefell, and the same thing happened in other countries, I'm thinking in Australia, two Australian guys got married. They were straight, but they got married because it gave them certain benefits that they didn't have as separate single persons. And they did not expect that union to last. It was just pragmatic. And of course, there was a hue and cry from the gay community for them doing that. But legally, there was no requirement that they be gay or that they even love each other. They could get married. They were the same sex. And so there was nothing to prevent that. And just to develop this point a little bit more, because it's really important, I think, Amy. This is the kind of thing that people don't see. That there is a wholeness. I'm even struggling to find the right word here. there is a rationale here. There was only, and you started saying it, the marriage is between a man and a woman because it produces children. And people say, well, not all married children, all married people have children. They're missing the point entirely. The only reason there are marriage licenses which regulate and privilege and protect this union is because, as a rule, as a group, and by nature, okay, as a rule, as a group, and by nature, they produce the next generation. Now, there are exceptions to that, but you don't make the laws based on the exceptions. If they didn't produce the next generation, nobody would get in the way. Nobody would get involved. No one would pass laws to regulate and protect and privilege, all right? Mike Koval was my doubles partner for years in tennis, okay? Nobody ever gave us anything special because we were doubles partners. You know, why not? Because it wasn't a relationship that there was any reason for the government to intrude on. Okay? But when you have children, which forms the foundation of culture and society, families, then the community has something to say about protecting that relationship. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea. That's the significant element that's here. And that's what a marriage actually is. And if we go the route, as we've done, of redefining, as you said, and another person put it essentially, was that all marriage is a list of names. That's all it is. It's just two people on a page. They're married. But there's nothing that defines the marriage. You know? Anyway, like you said, there's no criteria anymore.
Right, right. And so, I just saw an article in The New Yorker. Of course, this is probably going to air in a couple of weeks, so you'll have to, if anyone's looking for it. I think the title was something like How Polyamorous and Polygamists Are Challenging Family Norms. And that was in The New Yorker. So
most people know what polygamy is, but polyamory...
Oh, so that's just multiple partners married.
Group marriage.
Group marriage, right.
Essentially.
And they're saying in there, well, why not three? If two is fine. I mean, if people don't want single parents, then isn't three better than two? So when you remove it from any sort of reality of marriage as being something real that exists for a reason connected to reality, there is no principle. And we'll see more and more of this, I'm sure.
Well, I used to say, rub-a-dub-dub, three men in a tub with a cocker spaniel and a potted plant. Why not? That's the marriage, all five. Why not? You can't say no to any combination unless you have a clear idea of what marriage actually is. That is, it is established and determined to be a particular thing. And once you say it's nothing in particular, it's whatever you choose, then the doors open up to whatever. You can marry your cell phone. Some people probably feel they are married to their cell phone. But you can marry yourself. This happened in Europe. A woman married herself. It makes no sense, but it
happened.
I
don't think it was legally.
Anyway, but the point, I think, is significant. Because if there is no criterion that identifies what is normative, that doesn't mean like what everybody does, but what everybody's supposed to do. That's what that word means, prescriptive. If there's no criterion identifying what is normative, then there is nothing normative. Then it's anything. And why not? Why can't you marry your palm tree? Oh, that's not what marriage is. Who says who? Your grandma? Anyway, go ahead, Amy.
The irony of this, Greg, is that as Christians, we were arguing from natural law. We were arguing from looking at reality as it is, as the way that men and women function, and all of these things. We're talking about specific arguments connected to reality. Whereas those who were arguing for same-sex marriage were just arbitrarily saying, no, it's just two people. Mm-hmm. Love is love, but just for two people. Well, that is actually just prejudice. There's no reason for them to limit it to two people. It was just their own prejudice against larger groups. So they were actually the ones defining according to prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, now that will be broken down because there is no reason to keep it. There's no reason to keep marriage away from polyamorous or polygamous.
Right.
And I read so many articles at the time, oh, we'll never have polygamy because that's not good for women. Okay, well, what's your constitutional principle for that? Exactly. There is none. They tore the whole thing down.
And by the way, this is called a logical slippery slope. And a lot of people are dismissive of slippery slope charges or concerns or allegations. There are different types of them. A logical slippery slope is when you put into motion a line of thinking that has an initial consequence right now, but the exact same line of thinking that you established legally has other consequences that you're maybe not considering or even intending, but still the legal language allows that. And this is what we're talking about. We're talking about this. If you say that marriage is whatever, and whatever to us means this right now, well, whatever could mean something else to somebody else in a couple of weeks or months, and that gets included on the same line of reasoning. That's why they call it a logical slippery slope. And that's what's in play here. By the way, there's a logical slippery slope that relates to abortion and infanticide. If you can kill a baby inside the womb, why can't you kill a baby outside of the womb? Moving that baby 6 or 8 inches, that's inconsequential. Location is morally trivial. So why do we make that distinction of location? So now we can kill outside. So that's a logical slippery slope too. And it's good that people be mindful of these. That's what it means when people say ideas have consequences.
Mm-hmm. And again, I just have to point to Truman's book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, because his argument is he traces this line of thought is that the whole purpose of all of this from the beginning was to destroy the institutions. Mm-hmm. And he explains why and what their reasons for that were and how they view the world. It just will make so much more sense because a lot of us who have a more biblical worldview are a lot of times left completely bewildered by the way people argue or what they think our goals should be or any of these things because we don't understand how we got where we are and what the history of their ideas is. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just wanted to put one more plug in for that book.
Yeah, that's Truman, not like the president, but like true man. And this is why Stand to Reason is here, by the way, because we understand that navigating some of these things is difficult, these ideas. And I know just the same-sex marriage issue, it took me a long time to kind of figure out what was wrong and how to characterize how it was wrong. But we did figure it out and I think have a good grasp on it before Obergefell and then try to shout it from the rooftops. But so we are sympathetic that some of these, especially the more recent kinds of challenges like that one, same-sex marriage and like critical race theory and things, which we'll be talking about more this summer and I'll be writing more on. These are hard. These are challenging. That's why we're here to help you see what's going on and what Amy has just suggested with Carl Truman's book, The Rise and Fall of the Modern Self, right? Is that it? Is so helpful because it kind of lets you see what you didn't see before, what you couldn't see
before. The Rise and Triumph of the
Modern Self. What did I say?
The Rise and Fall.
Oh, see, I've got the Third Reich thing in my head right now because I'm reading that. The Rise and Triumph. Thank you. I wish it was The Rise and Fall. We haven't seen the fall yet.
Well, and, Greg, I promise you there will be a fall because nothing that is so untethered from reality can survive forever.
Yeah.
I guarantee.
So well put. Nothing that is so untethered from reality can survive long. Mm-hmm. But that's a relative term. We may not see the end of it. I mean, I'm 71. I don't know that I'll see a change in my lifetime. Maybe in the next couple of years. This is very hard to predict. But Christians better tighten their seatbelts. This is a message that I am trying to communicate. Tighten your seatbelts because it's going to get harder for you if you're faithful to Christ and the truth before it gets easier. Get ready.
All right. Thank you, Greg. And thank you, everyone, for your questions. Sorry we only got through one today, but it's an important one. I actually have a post on understanding the same-sex marriage issue, which links to a bunch of articles we've written on the topic. So if you haven't thought about this before, I recommend you go to our website.
You know, Amy, isn't there, we have a card too. We have a quick study card. And that's where, at least for me, I most carefully articulated these points.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I don't know, if you go to our store.
Right. Quick reference guide.
There it is.
Yeah.
To, I think, maybe to same-sex marriage, something like that is the title of
something,
it.
Something, yeah. I'm not sure the exact, but I'm sure they'll be able to find it. All right. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sending your questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.